It is a privilege to be here today, passing on to you not only the teachings of my great teacher, Shunryu Suzuki Roshi, but by passing on the meaning of his teachings, giving meaning to the practice of all of the great teachers, all the way back to Shakyamuni Buddha. Suzuki Roshi was really clear about our thoughts during Zazen. He said, when you are practicing Zazen, do not try to stop your thinking. Let it stop by itself. If something comes into your mind, let it come and let it go out. It will not stay long. When you try to stop, and this is Suzuki Roshi, when you try to stop your thinking, it means you're bothered by it. Do not be bothered by anything. It appears as if something comes from outside your mind, but actually, it's only the waves of your mind. And if you are not bothered by the waves, gradually they will become calmer and calmer. In 5 or at most 10 minutes, your mind will be completely serene and calm. At that time, your breathing will become quite low while your pulse will become a little faster. So basically he's saying, it's our getting upset about our thinking that agitates the thinking and keeps it going. And that it's sort of like we're creating our own by not being calm and just allowing the thoughts to subside on their own, which they will actually if you don't attach to them and start further thinking about them, they will subside. But it's interesting when he says, do not be bothered by anything, it sounds like that, well, that'll never be me. But when he goes on to say that it's not, the reason not to be bothered by anything is that nothing is coming from the outside. It's all our mind. And so we can take a little more charge of our minds by not clinging to the substance that it produces, the content that it produces. Roshi continues, usually we think of our mind as receiving impressions and experiences from outside, but that is not a true understanding of our mind. The true understanding is that the mind includes everything. When you think something comes from outside, it means only that something appears in your mind. Nothing outside yourself can cause any trouble. You yourself make the waves in your mind. If you leave your mind as it is, it will become calm. This mind is called big mind. If your mind is related to something outside itself, that mind is small mind, a limited mind. If your mind is not related to anything else, then there is no dualistic understanding in the activity of your mind. You understand activity just as just waves of your mind, and big mind experiences everything within itself. Actually, the mind which includes everything and the mind which is related to something else are the same thing, but the understanding is different, and your attitude towards your life will be different according to which understanding you have. So he basically is just repeating himself. If you understand big mind, you'll see that everything is your mind. Everything that happens is actually your mind, in your mind already. And and that mind is non-dualistic. And then our what we experience as our normal, regular mind sees our experience as self and other, and then others create uncomfortable experiences for us and so forth. Uchiyama Roshi, that's Okumura Roshi's teacher, has said, when you are born, your world is born with you. And when you die, so dies your entire world. Your true self includes the entire world you live in. And in this world, there is no possibility of exchange. So that's saying the same thing in a different, using different words. But I relate to that way of saying it. When you're born, your world is born with you. That makes sense to me. And when you die, so dies your entire world. And so that yourself includes the entire world. And in this world, there's no possibility of exchange with others. So what is the fresh and vibrant quality of this life of the absolute self? One thing we can be sure of is that we'll never discover it in the world of trading and exchanging with others. The true self has nothing to do with others. It is a self that lives totally within itself. The world as experienced is the world which the self alone, you alone, can experience. And then he gives an example that really makes this clear. Take two people looking at what they think of as the same cup. But when looking at a cup, you see it with your eyes, from your angle, with your vision, while I see it with my eyes, from my angle, and with my power of vision. There is no possibility of exchanging even our separate ways of looking at a cup. None of your personal experiences can ever be the same as anyone else's. More so, then, is your way of thinking bound to be different from everyone else's. The world, quote, the world is not some entity which exists apart from us. The world is where we function. Likewise, the life of the true self is not some entity apart from our functioning and working. Everything we encounter is our life. And I know for most of us, and certainly for me, that was a realization that didn't come until later, that everything I encounter is my life. To experience everything as included within your mind, as the essence of mind, is to have religious feeling. That's what Suzuki Roshi says. This in itself is religious feeling, to have everything included within your mind as the essence of your mind. Even though waves arise, the essence of your mind is pure. It is just like clear water with a few waves. Actually, water always has waves. Waves are the practice of water. I love that phrase. It's a Suzuki Roshi phrase. Waves are the practice of water. To speak of waves apart from water, or water apart from waves, is delusion. Big mind and small mind are one. When you understand your mind this way, you have some security in your feeling. As your mind does not expect anything from outside, it is always filled. A mind with waves in it is not a disturbed mind, but actually an amplified mind. whatever you experience is an expression of big mind. So in one sense, our experiences coming one by one are always fresh and new. But in another sense, they're nothing but a continuous or repeated unfolding of one big mind. For instance, if you have something good for breakfast, you say, "This is good," but good is supplied as something experienced some long time ago, even though you may not remember when. With big mind, we accept each of our experiences as if recognizing the face we see in a mirror as our own. For us, there is no fear of losing this mind. There is nowhere to come or go. There is no fear of death, no fear of old age or sickness. So we have imperturbable composure. And it is with this imperturbable composure of big mind that we practice Zazen. So now what I'm about to say is just me commenting on that. That one could read this to say that he, on some level, this is about Suzuki Roshi's dying, and when he died of cancer, he didn't take any drugs, and he just lived with the pain. And so I want to say the pain was there, but he didn't experience the pain as coming from somewhere else and attacking him so much as the way big mind was expressing itself minute by minute right now. So he stayed inside the pain, which he saw as his mind in the form of pain. Then one simply appreciates the current expression of big mind. Whatever we experience is an expression of big mind. So if we know this, nothing will bother us. We will still grow old and die, but we will appreciate watching this and not be perturbed. So Roshi gave us an example of that as he died. I only have read stories of people who were close to him and were in his room during his last days before he died. But I do know that he would have massage and things like that, but he didn't take pain medicine. Regarding imperturbable composure, Roshi says, because we enjoy all aspects of life as an unfolding big mind, we do not care for any excessive joy. So we have imperturbable composure. Again, Roshi's advice to his Zazen practitioners is not to try to stop our thinking. Because he says if we try to stop our thinking, it means we are bothered by it and we shouldn't be bothered by anything. Furthermore, nothing comes from outside. The mind includes everything. When we think something comes from outside, it means that something appears in our mind. So, you know, we all have this experience. Something comes to our mind and we think it's coming from out there. But we ourselves make the waves in our mind. If we leave our mind as they are, they will become calm. And this mind is called big mind. And I want to add to that, that the person I know with the most imperturbable composure is not a Zen student and knows nothing about big mind. He's a bodybuilder. He practices at a gym, focusing on one muscle group a day, 6 days a week, bringing that muscle group all the way to failure, which takes about an hour and a half. He loves crowded gyms and he goes at night when he's unnoticeable among many people. He eats 125 grams of protein a day to support muscle growth. His whole life is organized around his bodybuilding practice and has been for years. His friends all do it and they regularly party and travel together to various competitions. And he earns his living teaching bodybuilding. And to me, this is all about practice. You know, this is practice itself. It's not like he's studying Zen. But he has a practice, a really serious practice that's inviolable. He does the same thing with great care and attention, day after day, year after year. The results can be found in his stable and grounded body and mind, imperturbable composure, and it is with this imperturbable composure of big mind that we practice Zazen. Zen is not some kind of excitement, but concentration on our usual everyday routine. Some people start to practice just out of curiosity, and they only make themselves busier. If your practice makes you worse, it is ridiculous. Suzuki Roshi is saying that. But I want to say, because of my friend that I just described, I've had the thought that big mind, this idea of big mind, in this formula is extra. I mean, I'm saying this because some people have trouble with the concept of big mind. And I wonder actually if we really need this idea and is it even useful? It seems clear that practice in and of itself, whatever it is, so long as it's done carefully and with tender attention, keeps the mind pure. The difference between someone who has taken a practice and seen it all the way through and someone who has not done so is that upon which imperturbable composure is built. The former will have it and the latter won't. Maybe the concept of big mind really isn't necessary. That's me. I'm just putting that forth as a possibility. Remember when we talked about there is no need to have a deep understanding of Zen? Which is what your state of mind should be, not only as you listen to a talk about Zen, but as you listen to your life minute by minute. There's no need to have a deep understanding of Zen really means that there's nothing to understand. There's no secret outside of you living your everyday life with sincerity. The Zen way, the single-minded way, Roshi says, is like a railroad track, which is always the same. In each moment, we simply express our true nature and sincerity. Sincerity is the track. There's no starting point, no goal, nothing to attain, just to run on the track continuously. That is the mind of a practitioner. That's Roshi's metaphor. It's crystal clear. It's just crystal clear. There's a railroad track. You're always on it, da 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 da, day after day, year after year. There's no need for special joy or excitement or any other thing. It's just stay continuously on the track. And that leads to imperturbable composure. So, to this point, I'd like to tell you again. A story about Shakyamuni Buddha teaching a disciple named Bahiya. I've told you the story once before, but it perfectly demonstrates this point. So it's in the scriptures. There's no reason not to hear it. Really endless times. So in the early scriptures, there's a yogi named Bahiya, who was revered and honored as a worthy one. But when he was alone, he wondered whether his understanding was complete. While he was wondering about this, a deity came to him and told him that his understanding was not mature. But fortunately, there was an awakened one who could help him. So Bahia immediately set off to meet the Buddha. At that time, it was customary for monks to beg for food, and Bahia met the Buddha while he was in a town with his disciples on a begging round. So Bahia found the Buddha and asked him for a teaching for his own welfare and bliss, and the Buddha responded, "Now is not a good time, Bahia. We are engaged in begging." Bahia said, "We don't know what danger awaits us." In other words, we could die at any time. "Please teach me for my long-term welfare and bliss." The same exchange was repeated three times, and after the third request, the Buddha began to teach him. And this is customary for a master to wait for a disciple to show his integrity before offering a teaching. And here's the teaching, and that this is, you've heard this before, but it's relevant for today. Here in Bahia, you should train yourself thus. In the seen will be merely what is seen. In the heard will be merely what is heard. In the sensed will be merely what is sensed. In the cognized will be merely what is cognized. In this way, you should train yourself, Bahia. The Buddha goes on to explain about how this practice of letting things be themselves and letting them go will benefit Bahia. And then he says, "Just this is the end of suffering." Actually, this is a very sophisticated practice, but we've talked about it recently, as you might remember, with regard to Dogen's idea about how to attend a Dharma talk. You know, you're attending a Dharma talk and you, as the listener, you just listen. You know, "I am now listening to the Dharma talk," period. And then as the speaker, you just speak, you know, "I am now giving a Dharma talk." End of story. And that Dogen went so far as to do this with no content at all, just to make the point that I am now giving a Dharma talk and you are now listening to a Dharma talk. Thank you very much. See you next week. Literally, Dogen really did that, although it's probably "see you tomorrow." To make the point that this is a ritual. It's a gesture to enact the sincerity of our being, the purity and sincerity of our being. So I talk and you listen, and that's all that needs to take place. You don't need to understand anything. And you don't need to worry about not understanding anything. And then when you sit zazen, it's the same thing. You sit, you're sitting zazen in your posture, and you take that posture, and you have imperturbable composure. And thoughts come into your mind, and you just notice, "Oh, there's a thought coming into my mind." And honestly, if you do nothing more than that, the thought will pass out of your mind. It's like knocking for attention. If you don't give it to the attention, it goes away. So it's like hearing is going on and you're recognizing hearing, and that's all. So in this story, Bahia entered into perfect wisdom immediately. Then the Buddha went away, and not long after, accidentally, Bahia got caught between a mother water buffalo and her calf, and he died. So he must have had a premonition. But we should understand that in realizing the Buddha's teaching for himself, Bahia also realized this teaching for us. Suzuki Roshi will often say before he gives a talk, "The purpose of my talk is not to give you some intellectual understanding, but just to express my appreciation of our Zen practice." And Dogen Zenji said, "To cook, for example, is not to prepare food for yourself or someone else. It is to express your sincerity. Whatever you do should express the same deep sincerity." And we should appreciate what we're doing. There is no preparation for something else. And Roshi also says, it is almost impossible to talk about Buddhism. So not to say anything, just to practice it, is the best way. Saying nothing, however, also has problems. Showing one finger or holding up a flower to a person who understands already will mean everything. And to the person who doesn't, it could even deter, like they could think, oh, this is stupid. And you could just dismiss the whole thing. So even though words cannot express it, saying this is important. Therefore, Roshi says that talking about it and listening to it being talked about will be one of our practices, but we will just be talking about something and just be listening to someone talk about something without trying to figure out some intellectual understanding. So sometimes we listen, sometimes we talk, and that's all. But then he says, but don't listen too closely. There's no need to remember what I say. Last week, I think we had a question about that. And is that really true? And yes, it's true, because it's all a ritual. It's all a ritual that we go through to express our sincerity. And Roshi ends by saying, if you just continue in your normal, ordinary way, your character will be built up because it is just going back to just you, and that's your strongest suit. So here are some of the most important points. There are five of them. First, when you're practicing Zazen, do not try to stop your thinking. Let it stop by itself. If something comes into your mind, let it come in and let it go out. It will not stay long. And again, what makes it stay long is grasping your thoughts and trying to continue from there. Oh, well, I'll just follow that thought because it's interesting or whatever. The second point is the true understanding is that the mind includes everything. When you think something comes from outside, it means only that something appears in your mind. Nothing outside yourself can cause any trouble. You yourself make the waves in your mind. If you leave your mind as it is, it will become calm. And this mind is called big mind. And thirdly, what Uchiyama Roshi said, when you were born, your world is born with you. And when you die, so dies your entire world. Your true self includes the entire world you live in, and this world, and in this world, there is no possibility of exchange. It's a little hard. It's a little hard to accept, because it means that, you know, like what's going on in Russia right now is me. That's my mind. It's hard. And the last point is, for us, there is no fear of losing this mind. There is nowhere to come or go. There is no fear of death, no suffering from old age or sickness, because we will enjoy all aspects of life as an unfolding of big mind. We do not care for any excessive joy. So we have imperturbable composure, and it is with this imperturbable composure, a big mind, that we practice Zazen. So here is an idea for your reflection during the week. The 5 points that I have listed as some of the main points from today's talk are not just main points from today's talk, but are main points for Zen Buddhism. All of them are important for a true understanding of Zen. But as we know, we don't understand Zen with our minds. We understand Zen with our bodies. Therefore, I would like you during the week to immerse yourself in the 4th and 5th main points for this week. Take these 2 teachings completely to heart and really live them. Process everything that happens to you through them. And then, I repeat the two last points. Big and small mind are one. When you understand your mind this way, you have some security in your feeling. As your mind does not expect anything from outside, it is always filled. A mind with waves in it is not a disturbed mind, but an amplified one. Whatever you experience is an expression of your big mind. That's one. And then for us, there is no fear of losing this mind. There is nowhere to come or go. There is no fear of death, no suffering from old age or sickness, because we enjoy all aspects of life as an unfolding of big mind. We do not care for any excessive joy. So we have imperturbable composure, and it is with this imperturbable composure of big mind that we practice Zazen. So those two, they're really, they really boil down to, we don't expect anything from the outside. Whatever you experience is an expression of big mind. I'd like to, if that's too much for you, if that's too complicated, then an alternative practice that does the same thing is this exercise that the Buddha gave to Bahia. In the seen will be merely what is seen, in the cognized will be merely what is cognized, and in the heard will be merely what is heard. And in this is the way you should train yourself. So you could choose that too, either to immerse yourself in the 4th and 5th main points for the week, which will be written out, or this practice of Bahia's given to him by the Buddha, of when you talk, you're just talking, and when you listen, there's just listening. And that's the end of suffering. To kind of really zero in on that this week and see if you can get in touch with how that is so true. It takes a little adjustment, but once you click into it, you won't be able to not see it. Well, today's talk was a short talk, and it leaves us extra time if you have any to ask questions. And I've been inviting you to ask questions about your own personal practice. And of course, you can ask questions about anything that we've said so far in any of the talks. I hope I can remember the right answer, but if something is on your mind about Zen practice, please take this opportunity. Thank you.
Thank you, Gil. We have a question. Should I ask?
Yes.
Okay, so the first one that we got is, from this talk, I'm understanding that big mind is the whole world of everything that begins when we're born and ends when we die. If this is so, then as you said, in reference to two people seeing a cup, there are different individual worlds for each different person and being. How does this fit in with a non-dualistic understanding and the idea of no self? Maybe I'm understanding what big mind refers to. Is it not the same as Buddha mind?
Yes, and it's also the same as big mind and no self and non-dualism. Because you can see the non-dualism. It's only one big mind. So there isn't, there's not a duality. There's not anything from everything from the mind, everything that you experience, it's created by your mind. So Suzuki Roshi is saying, like in today's talk, everything comes from within your mind. Nothing is coming from the outside. When we feel we're experiencing something from the outside, it's just a wave arising in your mind. And he's saying that we create our own waves. So if you allow the waves to calm themselves, they will. And that's why he says we shouldn't ever be bothered by anything, because our practice should be allowing the waves of the mind, which, don't forget, are the practice. Waves are the practice. Waves are the practice of water, and water in this case is our mind. So waves are the practice of our mind, and you can just let them go. But there's no distinction between that and yourself with a capital S and your non-dualistic self with a capital S, let's say. It's all one. I hope that answers your question. That's the answer to your question, as far as I know, as far as I can understand.
Thank you, Gail. So there is a follow-up question to that. So how are one person's world and another's connected?
Each of us has our own, you know, when each of us is born, we're born with the entire world. So each of us includes the whole world inside each of us is the whole world. So we each include each other. That's why it's scary, because if somebody is slaughtering a trillion individuals somewhere in the world, then I'm responsible. That's why it's scary. Thank you.
Thank you, Gail. So another one that we have is, so are you saying that if I have a question, I should just ask the question, not to get too embroiled in, should I ask this question? It's really a stupid question, or maybe I should wait and see what other people ask. I find myself getting very self-conscious and not asking when I really want to know.
You know, if you don't understand something, probably there are other people who don't understand something. So it helps not only them, but it helps me also, because if you don't understand something, it means that I didn't explain it well enough. And so, but I might not know that unless you ask the question. So that's why I'm encouraging you as much as possible to ask, just ask. Ask your questions. If you have a question, just ask it. There's no reason to be embarrassed. This, you can ask it totally anonymously. No one's going to know. And then you get your question hopefully answered. And someone else might get the same question answered. And I'll be alerted to the fact that I didn't explain that point well enough. So, and everything we talk about here is pretty subtle. I mean, we all understand this now. Zen Buddhism is a very subtle realm, and we can't go over it too much. So when in doubt, ask. Thank you. I'm glad you asked that question.
Thank you, Gail. So while you were answering, we got a question anonymously, and the question is, should we be committed or at least very aware of trying to discuss Zen with others? We could never match your effort, but some level of discussion seems to be important to make others aware of Zen's attributes.
I know, it's a slippery slope. Because as I know you already know this, there's a certain kind of mind that goes with Zen understanding, and it's based in the practice of Zazen. So if you talk about Zen with someone who doesn't have a Zazen practice or something comparable, it doesn't have to be Zazen, but something, but let's just say, I'm checking myself out now if I can actually say this, but I want to say that if they have a practice of any kind, like the bodybuilder I gave you an example of today, if they actually have a practice, it would be okay to talk about Zen Buddhism with them. The danger, if you talk about Zen Buddhism with someone who doesn't even know what a practice is, much less Zen practice, they won't know what you're talking about. Even worse, they might think they know what you're talking about, and probably won't, because as you know from doing Zazen, you can't really even say what Zazen is or even what it does. It's like unpindownable, but it does something. And that's something that's inexpressible and unpindownable, but totally changes your life. If someone hasn't done that, there's no context for it. So I encourage you to talk about Zen practice But I encourage you, but the practice part is really important to talk about practice. There, outside of practice, there's nothing to talk about with Zen. I mean, the history is unimportant. I mean, everything is unimportant outside of the practice. And then definitely, if you know of other people who are practicing anything, you know, anything, any practice, then I think that's game for a discussion. I hope I made myself clear. It's not like we're this elite group or anything like that. It's just that without the experience of Zazen, there won't be a context to receive what a Zen practitioner is talking about. And you'll probably get some kind of comment that will show you that they didn't really understand. But go ahead and try. I mean, there's no harm in trying. I guess mainly the harm could be you turn someone off. And it'd be a shame to turn someone off Zen practice before they even tried it. Okay, enough said. Thank you.
Thank you, Gail. So, and another one that we just got is, how different is Zen from other forms of Buddhism?
It's quite different. It's very different from Tibetan Buddhism. Tibetan Buddhism is full of, you know, we have the ritual of sitting on our cushion with a straight back, or listening to a Dharma talk, or maybe having a little service with some bows. Tibetan Buddhism has a trillion rituals that go on and on and on. They're all very meaningful and very beautiful, and powerful as well. And a lot of the practices in Tibetan Buddhism you can't do until you have an empowerment. So in other words, you can't do it. There'll be a practice that you'll hear about that will accomplish a certain thing. You'll go, oh, I'd like to do that. And you learn about that practice, but you're not allowed to do it until you have a formal empowerment. That is, you're empowered by a Rinpoche to receive that practice. And actually the practice won't work without the empowerment. So you can't just like do it anyway. I mean, you can, but it won't work, because it's empowered by the understanding of the person who empowers you, the enlightenment of the person who empowers you. So, and also they don't do exactly Zazen practice. Their meditation is a little bit different. And even that isn't just one thing. There's many different things. So that's Tibetan Buddhism. And Theravadan Buddhism is, it's mainly mindfulness practice, and it's done for the sake of your individual accomplishment and improvement. And as you know, in Zen, we practice for the sake of the benefit of all beings, and we don't try to accomplish anything. No gain Zen. So it's different in that way too. So that's, and then there's other kinds of Buddhism where it's just like chanting. There's a Nembutsu Buddhism. You just chant for Amitabha Buddha. And you know, that's a practice. So in the sense that that's a practice, it's all well and good, but you know, no practice is out of bounds for being called, you know, you can do anything, can be a practice, and that's a practice. So That's another form of Buddhism. I think it's maybe the most popular form of Buddhism in Japan today. I don't know exactly what it's called. Thank you.
Thank you, Gail. So another one that we got is, the first one that I'll ask is, teachings like yours today are very helpful. I've noticed that many people drawn to Zen or practicing residential suffer from so-called mental health issues, residentially suffer from so-called mental health issues, myself included, like depression, anxiety, in crisis, etc. Have you noticed the same? Can you comment on this?
So I think I understood the question as you've noticed that Zen practitioners often have mental health issues. They often have mental health issues like depression, anxiety, etc. I think what I've noticed, I put it a little bit differently to myself, and I don't think it holds just for Zen, but I think that a lot of people with mental health issues look for a way to heal themselves, either with therapy or without therapy. And one of the ways they use is starting some kind of spiritual practice. And Zen is just one of them. You know, you can become a more serious Christian. You can become a more serious Baptist. You can become a more serious fundamentalist, or a more serious Catholic, or any religion. And I think that I wouldn't say that that's a foolish thing to do, that our spiritual life and our psychological life both need attending to. So that's kind of what I've come to as a conclusion of this, of the, sort of this question, that they're separate. Our spiritual life is one thing and our psychological life is another thing. They're closely related, but they're not the same. And there's different tracks to healing in both of them. So the fact that we have a spiritual practice doesn't exclude that we may also need to be having psychological help, and vice versa. The fact that you're in therapy, let's say, and you're very serious and you're doing it regularly, doesn't mean that you can bypass a spiritual practice. A lot of times there's an expression, spiritual bypassing, because it works this way a lot, that if someone will have a spiritual practice and they'll go, oh, you know, all I need is God, basically, or all I need is my Zen practice. And so they don't need therapy or they don't need any kind of psychological support. And that's called, and oftentimes their psychological problems continue and they continue to irritate others. But they say, no, all I need is to sit or something. And that's called spiritual bypassing. And I don't know the other phrase, there's probably another phrase for people who have serious psychological practices, but no spiritual one. I don't know what that's called, but anyway, we all need both, because we all have both of those sides of us. I've thought about that question for a long time, and that's what I've come to. Thank you.
Thank you, Gail. So another one is, what will I do at 10 on Sunday mornings in the future? This has been so important to me.
You know, the first thing if I were you, and I may even do this myself, the first thing to do is to start at the beginning of the series and listen to every single talk again. These talks are, I really threw my whole self into studying the material and making the presentation as clear as possible and so forth. They're worth listening to again. There will be, by the end of this, 127 of them. And that can carry you, you know, for a long time. So one thing you can do is re-listen to the talks. And now that you've heard all of them, or most of them, or whatever, going back, you'll hear them with a different mind. And they'll sink in a different way. And since we're looking for them entering your body will have a different experience. And so that could be very valuable. And also don't forget the questions and answers, that tab on my website that has the highlights of questions that people have asked, with kind of slightly edited answers so that they're more succinct, so that you can just even in a spare 10 minutes, just start thumbing through those. And I've created sets of 10 sets of them so that you don't ever have to repeat them. You can just do one set at a time. And there's a certain number in that, I can't remember how many, but it's like one sitting's worth. And then you're done with that. But again, those questions are ongoing. And that's another thing to take advantage of, because they're right there on the website. And then the final suggestion I have is my own teacher, Tenzin Roshi, commonly known as Reb. When he gives Dharma talks, they're always on Sunday morning at 10, unfortunately. So I miss a lot of his talks. And he doesn't give them every week, but I would say maybe once every 6 weeks or so. But those are worth listening to also. They're just wonderful, I think. The reason I know is you can listen to them later, and I do that whenever I can. So those are my suggestions, at least to start with. Review all of this material so that you really will feel like it's in me, it's in my body. My goodness, I think I have to stop. And again, as always, I want to thank you very much for being here. It means so much to me that you're here listening, and also the people who listen during the week. And then my team, Brian and Sahar and Brendan, who do a lot behind the scenes to make these talks possible. I thank you all. And I'll see you next week. Bye-bye.